Welcome to Give Theory a Chance. In this episode, we are joined by Dr. Neil McLaughlin, professor of sociology at McMaster University and author of Eric Fromm and the Global Public Sociology. In our conversation, Neil discusses the rise, fall, and potential resurgence of the writings of Eric Fromm. Neil reflects on the value of Fromm's work in this current political moment, as well as the lessons sociologists can learn about the possibilities and pitfalls of communicating to the larger public. In addition to the aforementioned book, Neil has published a significant number of articles on Eric Fromm. Check out the show notes for links to some of the ones mentioned in our talk, and also just a few of the recent ones I think are definitely worth reading. Hi, Neil. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
So we're here to talk about Eric Fromm. I'm wondering if you could just give us a short introduction to who they were or what they're known for. And considering how much you've published on this person, it might be a challenge to just give this tiny introduction, but we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, you know, Eric Fromm was born in 1900, and he was an early and central figure in the Frankfurt School. So he's an example of a critical theorist. But he's a bit of an unusual critical theorist because he studied with Alfred Weber, Max Weber's younger brother. So he had kind of credentials within sociology itself. But he was also a Freudian and a psychoanalyst, and he was a popular writer, what today we would call a public intellectual or public sociologist. So that's sort of who he was, and he fled the Nazis, and he wrote a book called Escape from Freedom, which is a sort of sociological analysis of fascism and the far right, which is, I think, coming back into unfortunately, some relevance today. So that's the basics of who he was.
Do you get a sense that he is widely read within the discipline of sociology?
Well, I wrote a piece in 1996 called How to Become, Michel Lamont has this very influential AJS piece on how to become a dominant French philosopher, the case of Jack Derrida, and it's sort of about how you get canonized. So I wrote a piece called How to Become a Forgotten Intellectual, the case of Eric Fromm. So from around 1940 or so to the mid-60s, he was a very influential thinker. He was cited in psychology textbooks. He published in ASR. Merton used to teach him at Columbia. He was widely cited in sociology. He was also very influential on the New Left and the political movements of the 60s. But by the 70s or so, he kind of dropped off the map and has become kind of a forgotten thinker. So I don't think people read him very much in sociology, although there is a bit of a revival going on. And Lynn Chancer and I have an article in the newest issue of Sociological Form about a revival of Eric Fromm. So I think he's coming back and to being read, but he is definitely someone people know but don't really read anymore as much as I think they might.
I'm wondering, without getting too sidetracked on this topic, do you have any theories why he disappeared, or can you share some of the insights from that article about how to become a forgotten intellectual, although that's not the goals that we have, maybe to avoid it?
Yeah, well, I tried to do a consulting company to teach intellectuals how to become forgotten, but I didn't get any business. You know, it didn't work out. Well, I would like put it into four different categories. If I want to give the most abstract explanation of why Fromm became a forgotten intellectual, he was a Marxist who popularized Marx more than anyone in sociology in America in the 40s and 50s. He really brought in the early Marx and the theories of alienation into American sociology and to American intellectual life more generally. So he was he had a lot of enemies among anti-Marxists and conservatives, but he was an opponent of Maoism and Stalinism. So Orthodox Marxists hated him even more than conservatives did. So that was one pillar. So he kind of got it from both ends. Mm-hmm. And the same issue happened within psychoanalysis. Probably no one other than Freud himself and maybe Erik Erikson sold more books popularizing Freudian ideas in America. And so anti-Freudians hated him, but he was a critic of Orthodox Freud, just like he was a critic of Orthodox Marxism. So he became a target for Orthodox Freudians who attacked him. So those are sort of the two pillars. I think a third thing is he was quite unique and then he sold mass market books. So The Art of Loving sold 26 million copies. He was a really major public intellectual. So I think he lost some of his reputation for being too popular, too much of a, or he did public intellectual stuff before it was a cool thing to do, or public sociology before it was a cool thing to do. And the fourth reason, he got caught between the disciplinary divisions. So he was a sociologist, but many sociologists see him as a psychoanalyst or a psychologist. And psychologists said the same thing. They said he's not really a Freudian. He's not really a psychologist. He's a sociologist. So I think that those four things kind of combined doomed his reputation.
When we think of a popular intellectual now, we have a much lower bar, right? 25 million is an absurd number. It's hard to even imagine a sociologist selling something like that at this point.
Yeah, I mean, he had around 13 books that sold over a million copies.
Yeah.
So there was it was just quite extraordinary. He was basically he was in the period after the invention of the paperback book and before the invention of social media, the internet. He was kind of in that period and really pioneered that kind of writing.
Do you think that his relationship to the Frankfurt School has hurt his place within sociology? And what I mean is that, yeah. I mean, in your articles, you talk about the tension he has with the other core members of the school.
Yeah.
And then, but he's still lumped in with that group. So then as you have readers that are put out and they say, all right, well, we have to include the one or two readings from the Frankfurt School. He's not going to be the person that's included, but you already checked off the box for that group of intellectuals. So he's the first cut that happens.
Absolutely. So I wrote a piece called Origin Myths in the Social Sciences, which was essentially about how he got written out of the history of the Frankfurt School. So he was a central figure in the Frankfurt School before Adorno, far more central than Marcuse was. And by 1938, 39, he is essentially kicked out. And then he became famous writing this book called Escape from Freedom. So there's a story there where they disliked him, and Adorno in particular and Marcuse ran a kind of an informal trash Fromm kind of campaign. But the thing is, Fromm didn't really want to be associated with them either after he became famous. So they both had kind of an interest in rewriting that history or forgetting about that history. But the irony is he's the most sociological of the Frankfurt School by far. When the Frankfurt School fled the Nazis and went to Switzerland first, and then they were brought to Columbia University, Robert Lind in sociology he played a central role in bringing him there. It was Fromm that they wanted, not the other figures, because Fromm had done an empirical study. It's called the Working Class in Weimar study, and it was an empirical piece of analysis of why workers and middle class Germans were voting for the Nazis. So he's by far the most sociological of the Frankfurt School.
Yeah, and you already talked about his credentials from having studied with the lesser known Weber, right?
So. Yeah, absolutely. And the thinker that he was most influenced by was actually Zimmel. You can see his books. He was very much influenced by Zimmel.
Who's another, I recently recorded a podcast on Zimmel with Daniel Silver, and part of that story as well is thinking about not forgotten to the same degree as Fromm, but having the central place and then having it drop down and having to trace the elements and see where his influence is.
Absolutely. Now, there's a kind of caveats about this, because Fromm in America and Canada and the United States, the Anglosphere, he really became forgotten, but he still remains very influential in Latin America. He went to Mexico in 1950, and he stayed there for years. And he had influence on Paulo Freire, so he's very influential in Brazil and around Latin America and in Mexico and in Eastern Central Europe, because he was a dissident Marxist. He was an anti-Stalinist Marxist. So in Poland, in Hungary, in parts of the region, the former Yugoslavia in particular, he was very influential there. and in Germany has a bit more resonance than in the United States. So it varies, but the basic story is the same everywhere. He got written out of the sociological canon.
I'm really curious about, with the resurgence of Fromm, one of the challenges that you brought up was that he exists in that space between sociology and psychology, yeah. right, where he's drawing on elements of both, and in some ways that create a challenge. It seems to me, and maybe I'm exaggerating this just because of the journals and the scholars I read, that there's a renewed interest within sociology in trying to understand things like emotions and motivation and drawing on the psychological research a bit more than previously. Yeah, has that helped with the resurgence, where those type of arguments or questions are now seen as valid? I'm wondering.
Oh, absolutely. So, Escape from Freedom, if you want to get into Fromm, I would definitely recommend Escape from Freedom, because it resonates today. It's a very readable book. It's something you could use for an intro sociology class or as a supplementary book for a contemporary theory class or a classical theory class, because he uses Weber, Marx, Durkheim, Simmel, Freud to explain the Nazis. So I have a piece that I kind of survey the book. It was in sociological theory, and I think it's 1998 or so, or 1996. And the title of that piece is Escape from Freedom Revisited, Nazism, Nationalism, and the Sociology of Emotions. So he was a sociologist of emotions before Arlie Hochschild. So she draws on him in kind of a minor way. And she's, of course, a much better sociologist than Erich Fromm was. He was dabbling in too many things. Yeah. So she's a real master sociologist. But he pioneered the commercialization of feelings that she writes about. This was core to what Fromm was writing about, yes. How ideas were transformed into emotions, and emotions are connected to the market. I mean, this is core to his arguments. So I think it's absolutely, the sociology of emotions is part of this return to Fromm.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how you first encountered and when you became aware of this person as a writer and a theorist. So when did you first read Fromm, and what was that experience like?
So I grew up in Canada, but I was really into soccer. I didn't go to university right off. I went to Scotland to try and play pro soccer. And there's a thing called CEGEPs in Quebec where I grew up, where they're kind of like two-year colleges after high school and before university. And a friend of mine went to CEGEP. I didn't go because I went to try to play soccer. But he was assigned the book Escape from Freedom by an American who was either draft dodger or draft resister, basically went to Canada to avoid the Vietnam War. And that book just sort of turned me on to ideas. I wasn't really an intellectual. I was playing soccer. And the book just, with a really important topic, just showed how it basically explains Marx's ideas and then critiques it and then uses them, explains Weber ideas, critiques it and uses them, explains Durkheim and uses Durkheim, and then talks about Freud. So it just sort of introduced me to the world of ideas. And what I noticed...
And you were reading this completely by yourself. It wasn't like totally, part of a reading group, not with friends. It was
just totally on by myself. And that's what he's quite... because of his writing skills and his intellectual style... He turns on people to ideas. That's probably one of his great strengths. So that's what happened to me. I basically just was turned on to ideas. And then I became a political activist in something called the Democratic Socialists of America, which is quite influential now. But at that time, it was like 6,000 people. We were a small little group of people. And so I became an activist. And then I went to graduate school at the City University of New York. And I had to come up with a thesis topic. And what I noticed is that the people that I knew in the American Socialist Movement, some of the leaders in the movement, because I ended up in New York and in and around a circle around some of the leaders, including Michael Harrington, who was their great intellectual leader. So many people I knew were brought into politics because of Eric Fromm. He mobilizes people. He inspires people. He brings people into the movement. But the leaders of the movement tended to be influenced by him when they were young, but then drop him later on. And the same thing happened in sociology. I knew so many people who said, yeah, I became a sociologist because I read Eric Fromm. But by the time you're doing your graduate seminars and you're doing your reading lists, Fromm became a kind of, he dropped off. So that's, yeah, that's what got me interested in the topic.
Was it seen as, embarrassing isn't the right term, but was there an element of stigma attached to remaining someone who reads? Was it seen as too simplistic? I mean, what was the reason that you saw it drop off among either the leaders or the academics?
I think it's a little bit different with the politics thing, because I do think he was a brilliant public intellectual, and he turned people on to socialist ideas. But as a strategist, I don't think he was a great political strategist. I actually have a piece coming out in a Routledge collection on Eric Fromm, in the spring, and it's basically how political was Eric Fromm. And I don't think he really was kind of a political strategist. In sociology, I think you hit the nail on the head there. And there's a new book by Roger Free, who's a psychoanalyst from Canada, from Simon Fraser out west in Canada. It's about the experience of Fromm's family, The Edge of Catastrophe, it's called, the experience of Fromm's family while he was writing The Escape from Freedom. And half his family were murdered by the Nazis in German Jewish intellectual. His family were murdered, and he was trying to get them out of Germany. And Roger he went to the London School of Economics. I think he did a master's in there. And he told Anthony Giddens that he was interested in Eric Fromm. And Giddens said something to him to the effect of, why would you be interested in such a woolly thinker? So yes, it's sort of like a simplistic.
Yeah.
I have a friend who I talk about political things and intellectual world, the world and anthropology. We never really talk about Eric Fromm, because when I first told her about my research, she said, she's German, and she said, Eric Fromm, he's a writer for teenage girls. So that's the reputation he got among academics.
Oh, fascinating. But yet you continued to read his work, and you either decided that it was okay to read the work for teenage girls, or that there was more to it. So
there's a lot more to it. It's just this is just a stereotype. This is just, what's wrong with writing for teenage girls? That's one issue. And then, it depends what you say, but it's just not true. I mean, the book is very sophisticated, historical, sociological. It has its flaws, and it's outdated in certain ways, but it's a very sophisticated work. So this is the sort of overcoming that woolly thinker book for teenage girls is part of what sociology has to overcome if we're going to become public sociologists,
I mean, and there's a lot too. We could spend a lot of time just on that, unpacking that critique itself, because I would say over and over you hear people say young people don't read anymore, and it's not that young people don't read anymore, it's that they don't read what we necessarily want them to be reading. We see graphic novels that are pretty nuanced in their thought and ideas that are selling millions of copies. And we see something like, a number of years ago, speaking of writing for teenage girls, the Twilight series. Everyone was reading this thing, right? So people are willing to read. And so as academics, we say, oh, well, that's just that writing because it's popular. Maybe the lens needs to be shifted the other way and say, how do we express ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I have a book on Eric Fromm and global public sociology, and that's the theme of the book, is sort of Fromm was an early public sociologist that sold way more copies of books than Du Bois or C. Wright Mills or David Riesman, the other people we think of as the public sociologists. Fromm was in another league in sales. And part of it was an ability to take complicated ideas and simplify them without being simplistic, and speaking and mobilizing people on that basis. And we could learn something from Fromm on that.
So when you were in grad school, Did you ever read his writing as part of a class or with a group, or did it continue to be this very independent, you started with that book and then you continued to read his other writings?
It was just my own thing. You know, I kind of, you know, basically people thought I was going to write a dissertation on like Swedish labor policy or something like that, you know, because I was sort of in a social democratic kind of orientation with Harrington, pro-labor kind of that was sort of my orientation. People thought that's what I would work on, and I just did this on my own.
Were there particular ideas of his other than this big picture type thinking and the accessibility and how inspiring his writing was? Were there particular ideas of Fromm's that you were influenced by, or was it more trying to understand his place as an intellectual and what we can learn from that?
Well, I think the idea of social character, the way that societies in a certain period and among certain social classes, the energy, the emotional energy and personalities of people are molded by the kind of society that you live in, and that this is a very powerful guide to how people behave and how they perceive the world. This is the marketing character was one of the most important ideas. So, I mean, another connection to thinking about Erich Fromm as a public sociologist is the other person who's a great public sociologist is David Riesman, who wrote The Lonely Crowd. He was a Harvard professor of sociology. Erich Fromm was his psychoanalyst. He was basically his shrink. And he became his mentor, his intellectual mentor, and his close friend, and they stayed in contact to Fromm's death. But basically, the idea of the other-directed and the inner-directed social character that Riesman developed, this came from Fromm. It was a modification of Fromm's ideas and an improvement in some ways. David Riesman improved Fromm in that. So that's one idea that I think is very productive and a very helpful, I think.
Have you taken those ideas, for instance, that idea or other ones from Fromm, and built them into your own research? Or has it more been that you research Fromm himself?
I think I'm kind of getting to that, you know. It's kind of, I mean, it's a little bit more, I have a complicated relationship to Fromm because I wouldn't argue that we should replace Bourdieu with Fromm, or that we should, you know, that we should sort of build sociology around Frommian ideas. I think that would be a big mistake. I think we have empirical methods. We have important theoretical frameworks that Fromm never really focused on. He was doing too many things. He was a psychoanalyst in the morning. He was a writer in the afternoon. So I don't think Fromm is a sort of a replacement for our theories. But he adds an element that our existing theories don't quite get. For example, I would say that I would argue that Fromm develops what I would call a kind of the psychoanalytic habitus. So we have in the Bourdieuian concept of habitus, it's a field dynamic. And Fromm brings a psychoanalytic lens about the psychology of various habituses. And I think he improves Bourdieu. So that's how I think about him, is sort of using him to fill in gaps that our existing theories don't do.
Yeah, and I can see the power of that type of approach, just based on the cursory explanation that you gave. But I could see the power of that type of approach for understanding the political moment that we're in.
Yeah.
Or for understanding the potential spaces for public intellectuals to emerge and the need for it, and I think sociology is failing in this regard.
Let me give an example, another example of how I'm trying to use Fromm in concrete. So I really have I study other public intellectuals, and I have a piece on kind of why Canada has so many far right wing public intellectuals on social media, and I'm writing a book about Jordan Peterson. So I have this sort of whole political sociology kind of agenda that's not primarily based on Fromm. I use standard sociological ways of thinking about this, but part of that is I have this project where I'm thinking about in Canada the universities are public, And in the United States, you had these elite private colleges. Mm-hmm. And so Fromm had this idea of a social filter. So Freudian ideas is essentially that people repress certain things from childhood. And it's sort of a psychoanalytic kind of lens for thinking about why you don't notice or deal with certain dynamics. Well, Fromm said there's a social filter where certain societies filter out certain perceptions and certain emotions. And that was sort of, and so one of the things that I really find quite interesting is that the American left, that I'm quite sympathetic to, and Bernie Sanders would be someone that I would, if I was voting in America, I would be on the Bernie camp. But it's quite striking to me that American leftists don't call for the taxing of private colleges in the United States, those endowments. And that's a Republican thing, and now really a far-right Republican thing. And so this is a kind of an example, I think, about something about American society that doesn't notice something, and that it's sort of a regressive way of organizing education. And most people in the rest of the world, Canadians find it quite sort of obvious what I say when I say this. They go, "Oh, yeah, that's a good point." But Americans often have a reaction and a kind of a complicated thing. And Fromm's idea of the social filter helps explain why certain things are hard to grasp within a particular culture.
Yeah, I'm recording this from New Haven, Connecticut, where I'm visiting my partner. And so looking at the sharp contrast between Yale and the surrounding community.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I have many friends who went to Yale and went to Columbia, and I don't support the Trumpist attacks on American universities. That's not something I'm sympathetic to. But there is a contradiction in American society that's kind of obvious, and there's a psychological mechanism that allows people to not notice it or not deal with it. And Fromm helps explain that.
Do you think there's space for the sociologist to lay out this kind of big picture, grand idea theorizing, especially in a more accessible way in academia right now? Because I think, and again, we could spend another hour talking about someone like Jordan Peterson, but with all the critiques of Jordan Peterson, the thing that he's offered is a narrative or a path or answers to people, right? He's saying like, here's the way you can live. Here's why you're struggling. Here is something to grab a hold of. And I do think sociology as a discipline can offer that stuff, but I don't think we do that. I don't even know if we do that in the classroom.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, my explanation of why Peterson is so famous is a sociological one, that he basically combines eight sociological roles. He's an academic, he's a clinician, he's a father figure, he's an entrepreneur, he's a media innovator, he's a spiritual leader, he's a public intellectual, and he's a celebrity. And he combines these eight things that don't really go together. Mm-hmm. They sort of they conflict with each other. And the conflict between these roles creates controversy. And we tend to go in and try and ban him or, cancel him. And I think we're making a mistake, because as misguided and as wrong as he is with his solutions and some of his analysis, he's pointing at issues that we tend to ignore. So I think it's not easy for sociologists to address some of these big issues. And I think we need to do a better job doing that.
In Fromm's writing, it's interesting because you point out that you found this on your own, you read this on your own. In a sense, it's a gateway drug to people caring about these ideas. And I'm just wondering if there's a lesson that we can follow in the type of writing that we can engage in, because it's not, there's a trap that sometimes we fall into when we talk about public sociology, where we just try to take the same idea and then write it in very simple language.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the answer, because that's not exactly what he's doing.
Right. Yeah, I think, the whole issue with the classroom, I guess it's these different roles. I mean, in terms of what's wrong with the universities, the thing that that Fromm did and that Peterson does is he spoke to people directly about their lives.
He was kind of, that's the preacher kind of thing. He really kind of, and we are caught in, and rightly so, we're doing empirical research, we're doing theories. We're not preachers to give people, you know, rules for living. So it's not that we should do that. It's just that there's a big gap if that's not being done. And so I think we should think about how we could, I mean, let's the gateway drug. I mean, the thing is, Peterson is the big gateway drug to ideas in the culture right now for a lot of young people. He's bringing people into ideas, and often bad ideas or, you know, problematic versions of ideas, but he's doing a better job than we are. And so I think we have to think about that.
And I think this is why he baffles so many of us, because the ideas don't seem inherently cool and exciting. They shouldn't be the thing that youth grab hold of and want to follow. And he also, here you might, I'm curious if you disagree with me here. It's not that his charisma is not the type of that we would normally point to and say, that's the charismatic individual that crowds will gather around. No. He's often kind of dry, and he engages in a lot of playing around with language and words, and points to many different references from all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet people will, an 18-year-old will sit down and watch an hour-long video of his who might fall asleep in our intro class.
Not 100%. It's extraordinary. And so it's, I think that challenge is something we as a discipline need to address. And that Fromm is a way of thinking about that. Fromm's case is a way of thinking about it, because he succeeded in doing this like no one else did.
One of the things I was thinking about this morning as I was going over some of your articles and preparing to talk to you is this question of why doesn't every sociology department have a 1-credit class or even a 3-credit class, which is lessons for life from sociology?
Absolutely. It would be a terrific thing to do. 100%. And, I think another thing that I would say about Fromm, that he there's problems in some of his ideas, but he was willing to talk to conservatives, and he was willing to talk to moderates. He was very clearly on the left, but he was not dogmatic in that way. So if we're going to talk about lessons for life to our students, we have to open up conversations with people that don't agree with our political viewpoints, because there's a lot of people who know a lot about living life. We have our grandparents and parents and kind of neighbors, and they don't necessarily share our politics or our view of the world. And so Fromm can help us do that.
And that should be a strength of sociology, in that we can point to actual empirical data, right? That's what we hold on to, which limits us from doing the type of grand theorizing that we see in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So we should be able to use that as a strength and say, here, we have the evidence to demonstrate this is a lesson that you could take away.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I think that would be a great thing to think about in terms of the discipline, integrating classes like that.
Considering the reemergence of Fromm, or the potential reemergence of Fromm, are there other intellectuals or theorists, or especially sociologists, that you think his work ties into nicely, or that Fromm's ideas can be placed into conversation with?
Well, I would say, again, on this theme of like connecting Fromm to existing theories and not replacing him, replacing existing theories. I would say that the great macro historical research on comparative fascisms, say, Barrington Moore and Theda Scotchpole about revolutions and Michael Mann. If you look at that work, it's brilliant stuff, and I would trust them for an analysis of fascism more than I would trust Escape from Freedom. The book is written a long time ago. But he has a social psychological angle that they tend to dismiss. They tend to argue for totally structural historical explanations, and they downplay character, personality, individuals. And it seems to me, and this is part of the reason why we have a revival of Fromm, that approach, the kind of macro-historical approach, if you said to somebody 20 years ago, we need to have a theory of narcissism to explain political sociology, They would woolly thinker, you know, that's kind of crazy. But how can you look at contemporary politics and Trump's character and not insist on not explaining the whole thing based on he's crazy? That's stupid. But there's something about his narcissism and his character that's central to how he behaves and what the appeal he has for people. And sociology has to have a theory of narcissism or sociological theory of narcissism.
Yeah, and thinking as Fromm did globally, the emergence of right-wing leaders around the world, this isn't, I mean, looking to Argentina, for instance, that type of analysis seems very relevant.
Absolutely, totally. And can you really understand Russia without something about Putin and his character? Yeah. I mean, of course you can't. So I would say, maybe kind of a Fromm as a foil for some of our great thinkers to kind of put him up against Barrington Moore, Theda Skocpol, Mann, Arlie Hochschild, kind of like push those thinkers, Bourdieu, push those thinkers a bit further with the psychoanalytic lens is what I'm recommending.
Thinking about your relationship to Fromm, is there a lesson, or perhaps it's a warning, I don't know, it depends on how you're feeling today. Is there a lesson for late undergrad students or early grad students who are thinking about how do you actually, what do you do with a theorist that you're inspired by?
Right.
Do you become the historian of that theorist? Do you become the disciple who just takes their ideas and then brings them in and goes and tests in the world or tries to convince the masses of their value? Do you become the critic of that theorist? You spend a lot of time with Fromm and you've engaged with him in so many different ways. Do you have advice or something that you could pass on?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, my dissertation was called, of course, Escape from Freedom was the Fromm's great book. My dissertation was called Escape from Orthodoxy. So the key lesson that I would offer is not getting wrapped up in orthodoxies, whether they Marxist or Freudian or sociological or political. So I think that Fromm is really useful for that. And as the Fromm revival happens, people get wrapped up, of course, in Frommian orthodoxy. Yeah. So I think I become more clear about what I think doesn't work in Fromm's framework, and especially what doesn't work in his politics. That's what I become more, probably the thing that I'm most clear about, is that read Fromm, be inspired by Fromm, but don't go out and think you can defeat Donald Trump by mobilizing Fromm's ideas, because it's not going to work. It's a long time ago. And there's a big difference between our intellectual ideas and what works in politics. And so that's probably, so I like to draw on other people and other sociological theories and research methods, and then political strategists outside the university who are often better at politics. I would say generally professors suck at politics. It's not really kind of what we do, you know?
Yeah.
And that's okay. You know, so
but
I
we're
think
good at critiquing others who are engaging politics. Very
and
good.
That, and we should do that, you know, we should do what we're good at. And I think it's very important that we do that. But I think sort of thinking that kind of our ideas or our sociological theories or methods can kind of somehow solve political problems and defeat Donald Trump, I think that's a big mistake.
So I like to end the podcast with a final question that you've answered to some degree already. So I'm going to give you a chance to add to that answer, but I'd like to add one other question along with it. So the big question is, reflecting on all the work you've done related to Eric Fromm, all the time you spent reading his ideas and sharing his ideas, if you were standing in front of undergraduates, grad students, the larger discipline or the public, what would you say to them about here's why you should engage in the task of reading his work? And then the addendum to that question is, you've mentioned his key book. What would be the other entryway into reading Fromm? Are there any other area, other ones that you should that you want to highlight as saying, well, this is one that you should also give a chance?
Well, this book called The Sane Society, which is basically talking about, and I'm quite influenced by Jonathan Haidt's work and his book on the anxious generation and kind of the role of social media in sort of an anxiety and depression crisis among young. So I think The Sane Society is essentially about the kind of insanity of modernity and what modernity is doing to people and their social psychological well-being. So I think he has an enormous amount to say about that. Marx's concept of man is a great introduction to the early Marx and the humanistic Marx. He has a brilliant book called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, which is about evil and destructiveness and violence. It's a nice kind of companion with Randall Collins's book on violence. Fromm gives a kind of a more social psychological analysis. He also has a terrific book called Social Character in a Mexican Village, which is essentially about the role of social psychology in development. So if I had to say sort of two things that I would sort of take from Fromm, one would be more kind of intellectual, and the other would be more on a kind of a personal level. And the intellectual one is that I think this idea, you know, that old joke about, you know, how many sociologists it take to screw in a light bulb? None, because it's not the light bulb that needs changing, it's society and its social structure. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a sort of a problem we have in the discipline. Because I do believe that the major problems in the society are structural and historical, and they're not kind of personality or people or kind of blaming the victim. But it's naive to think that you can really operate or understand the world without some attention to people's choices and their own agency and their own sort of psychological issues that we should look at. So it's kind of that's the answer to Jordan Peterson, that you should clean your room, be an individual, and all the social problems will be solved. And it's kind of pro-market extremism. The answer to that is not, it's all social structural and it's all history. And there's no reason to deal with social, psychological, and individual choices. That's a crazy kind of a false dichotomy. So Fromm helps us kind of find our way into deal. This is a hot button issue and very complicated because it leads into blaming the victim and all that. But it's sort of, we need to do a better job of avoiding that polarity. It's either society or the person. And Fromm is the best inroad into that. And we'll have to do a better job than he did in getting the specifics. But he's a place to start if we want to address that issue. That's the first thing. And the second thing is a more personal level. Paul Rosen, who's a political scientist who taught at York University, there's a whole bunch of people who write about Fromm came from Canada. There's a whole story about why that's true. But Paul was at York University, and he wrote an essay called Fromm's Courage. And that was one of the things that was very distinctive about Fromm. He was a Marxist, and he was willing to go against Stalinism or Maoism and say this kind of left-wing authoritarianism has to be opposed, even though I'm on the left. And he took a lot of flack for that. He also defended some of the people in the psychoanalytic world that were being attacked by Freud, that were being he was willing to say controversial things in the 1960s, both opposing the American Empire, opposing the Vietnam War, but also being critical of fellow leftists that were doing things that he thought were counterproductive. So Fromm had the courage to break out of the group that he was in. It was partly because he had lots of different groups that he was in. So maybe that's part of the lesson too, is sort of talk to different people. Yeah. Don't put all your eggs in one kind of organizational or intellectual basket. and kind of so that gives you a little bit of options so that you can have the courage to speak your mind. And Fromm did that more than many people.
I think that's a wonderful point to end on. So thank you so much for this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. Thank you.
Appreciation goes to Jeffrey Gilbert for providing theme music, SUNY Brockport for providing financial support, and most importantly, on behalf of me, Kyle Green, thank you for giving Theory a chance.